This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello, welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today I'm interviewing Ian Hamilton, Associate Professor of Addiction at the University of York. Ian is interested in the relationship between substance use and mental health, and has written the ACAM topic guide on addiction and substance use. Ian, welcome. Can you start by introducing yourself with a few details about your role?
Yes, it's a pleasure to do this. So I'm based, as you said, at the University of York. And prior to joining the university as a researcher and lecturer, I was working with mainly people who had drug and alcohol problems, but also co-occurring mental health problems. In fact, it's really difficult to find people who have problems with addiction who don't also have mental health problems. So I worked as a psychiatric nurse with those people for 10, 15 years. And then using that experience, really, started at the university doing research into the same broad area, really. So that's what I've carried on doing since.
Mm-hmm. You may have partially answered this already, but as you say, you trained and worked as a psychiatric nurse. How did you come to be interested in this dual relationship of substance use and mental health? Was it purely because you kept witnessing this dual relationship?
Yes, in part, but I think I was just also lucky in that the area I trained in had an NHS residential drug detox unit, which was one of, I don't think any of them exist now, but going back 20 odd years, it was one of very few NHS funded residential detox inpatient units. So that's where my interest was sparked. You know, people were very articulate. They clearly all had one thing in common, and that was that they'd experienced some kind of adversity, either as they were growing up or later on in adulthood. So it was through them, really, just talking about their experiences and sharing those with me that I became interested.
Mm. I'm curious about what the mental health issues were that you can differentiate from substance use issues.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a whole spectrum, aren't there? We know that some drugs are associated with very specific mental health reactions. So, you know, a very obvious one that most people know about is cannabis. And we still don't know whether cannabis actually triggers psychosis, but it's certainly strongly associated with it. And you'd be hard pushed as a psychologist, as a medic, as a nurse, not to come across people who have developed mental health problems alongside their cannabis use. And it also seems that when they reduce their cannabis use, those, for some of them anyway, their particularly psychotic symptoms kind of tail away. But then when they restart cannabis use, unfortunately, they experience usually quite acute reactions. So there's those kind of very distinct relationships. But I think generally, because there's a commonality between poor mental health and problematic substance use in particularly childhood or formative years, where people, I guess, use substances to cope with whatever kind of trauma they've experienced. And alongside that, you have things like depression and anxiety or even post-traumatic stress disorder. So you end up with this kind of tangle, really, of, you know, life events, substance use and reactive mental health problems.
Right. It's probably quite hard to unpick.
Yeah, I think it is. And I think that's a challenge for practitioners is, you know, I think practitioners and researchers are particularly curious about which came first. Was it the drug problem that then created the mental health problem or vice versa? And in truth, I've not met many clients who are equally as fascinated. They just want help. They don't really care which came first. But of course, understanding which came first may help with treatment, but it's just that really sharing just an observation of the difference between what clients think is important and what practitioners see as important.
We'll look at that in more detail. I just want to look at numbers. So in your topic guide, you cite Home Office figures on drug use. And I'm wondering what is known about the prevalence and trends of drug use amongst young people in the UK?
Well, it's a pretty short reply. Not a lot, really. I think some of the problems with counting the number of young people with a drug problem are similar to those with an adult. I don't want to go through it all, but for example, because most of these drugs are illegal, that in itself means it's potentially a barrier to people admitting to use, obviously, and perhaps even more so as a child or a younger person. But also, I think the part of the problem is just getting good, accurate, and reliable information about how many people are using drugs, whether you're adult or a young person. So, for example, in adults, the particular problem is that people who are homeless and those in prisons and those with an address which is a university one are excluded from these surveys. Now, obviously, the latter group doesn't really apply to young people, but certainly, you know, being in custodial care or being not having a home, being roofless, means that we've underestimated the number of young people who use drugs. But the Home Office data is the best of what we have, really. So, and what it does help with is spotting trends over time. So you wouldn't want to use a single year as being informative of what's going on, but you can see trends over time.
Mm-hmm. And what about alcohol and tobacco? I think in the guide you describe these as drugs as much as any other substance, but they're played down in some way, I think. Would you agree?
Yeah, I agree totally, Joe. So, I mean, what the alcohol industry has very cleverly done is even informed the way that we use the expression drugs and alcohol, separating the two. And of course, alcohol is a drug. It may be regulated in a different way, but it's as much a drug as crack cocaine is or amphetamine. So, you know, the industry's had a hand in this and many other things. But yes, and alcohol and tobacco, of course, are two of the most commonly used drugs in society. And no great surprise, they're also two of the drugs that we're most likely to be initiated into as we develop through our life, you know, particularly in your teenage years. And we know that, unfortunately, they have quite severe health consequences for people when they're used, frequently and in a greater quantity.
So are they a kind of gateway for young people into other substance use?
I think they definitely are, you know, and if we take the example of tobacco, rather uniquely in the UK, we have a tradition of rolling cannabis joints with tobacco, even though there may not be a need to do that. In the past, there was a need because it was the way you combusted cannabis resin, but there isn't always a need to do that now. And so we estimate that something like 7 out of 10 young people who smoke cannabis do that with a joint as tobacco in it. So inadvertently, they may consider themselves as non-smokers, non-tobacco smokers, but of course they're opening themselves up to the risk of becoming dependent on tobacco inadvertently through their exposure to cannabis joints.
Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering why alcohol and tobacco have been played down. Is that the pressure that comes from industry, or is there something else at play?
Yeah, no, I think it's a good point. In part, I mean, we can't just blame industry on its own. I think there's just wider acceptance, isn't there, that, you know, you can't escape alcohol. You can escape tobacco. Tobacco, of course, because there's been a concerted effort to reduce the population use of smoking, and that's largely been successful. But alcohol still remains embedded in everything that we do culturally from birth to death, and everything in between. So, as a drug in society, it's a rather odd position to be in, where we celebrate, we kind of invite young people to use alcohol in a way that we wouldn't do with many other drugs, really.
Yeah, it's often not thought about, isn't it?
Absolutely. or even to the extent that we want to prepare young people for our adult kind of career alcohol use by, you know, this whole debate over whether it's right or wrong to introduce alcohol to a child at an early age. And, you know, we look to France for guidance on this and hold them in great esteem in terms of, you know, having a little bit of alcohol with a meal, etc. I mean, I think it's important to say overall, whether it's alcohol or any other drug, the vast majority of young people who use drugs won't develop a problem. So it might be better for their health if they reduce their intake, but they're not going to develop, you know, cancer or die early or, you know, have any other adverse outcome. In fact, most of what they'll experience will be pleasure. And that's something that's really been underplayed, I think, in drugs research, is we need to say what's normal. And what's normal is for young people not to use drugs rather than to use them. So the vast majority of young people won't use drugs. Of those that do, again, the vast majority will not come to any harm and likely just enjoy it, but then grow out of their use.
Right. Of those young people that do experiment with drugs, and one thinks of adolescence as a time when you might be experimenting, what are the factors that make some young people at risk of developing problems with substance use, while for others the impact is minimal?
Yeah, so again, that's a good point. We're still trying to understand this. As best as we can tell, it would seem to be around a very strong correlation between adverse childhood events and drug use, and or problem drug use, not just drug use. So why, you know, exactly, why does one person, young person, able to pick up and drop cannabis as they choose, but for others, they end up using it every day and maybe go on to use other drugs? So there may be different theories explain this, but one I'm particularly drawn to is this idea of self-medication. So actually what people find, young people find, is that drugs work in a way that nothing else they try does. So cannabis, for instance, may well just dampen down feelings or thoughts that they have that they find troublesome. It may even give them some pleasure and some, you know, feeling of warmth and contentment that they don't get in life. So in that way, they're medicating against something that's negative or adverse in their life or their current experience.
I suppose conversely, what factors are protective?
Well, you know, I don't think this will be a surprise to anyone, but, you know, having good family relations, having a family, first of all, and having a supportive family, as well as what's broadly thought of or termed social capital. So just, you know, again, family, having opportunities in terms of education, being encouraged, being supported, having networks of friends who, again, have a healthy relationship with. I think just broadly being encouraged, and when you do have problems, having some bank of experience of how to deal with those and some feeling of certainty that you can go and get help should you need it. I think what we'd all strive for as parents and those that are interested in young people, just ensuring that they feel supported, feel encouraged, and are nurtured. And obviously, all of those aspects are compromised for young people who do end up having problems with drugs, is because, again, they're trying to soothe and trying to fill that void in their life.
I was going to ask about the signs that parents and professionals can look for that indicate problem drug use in children and young people, but from what you're saying it's really essential to have somebody, probably an adult, rooting for you, batting for you. And actually, for some of the people most likely to be affected, they may not have that.
They may not, but I think it's as I say, I've got to be careful here, because our knowledge around who's at risk is just developing, and it's shockingly poor, to be honest. So our ability to predict who is at risk, particularly which young person might be at risk, we can put together a constellation of factors, but that is not foolproof, you know. So just falling out of education, perhaps having contact with the police, an experience of abuse, would all be indicators, but then they don't necessarily guarantee that someone will develop a drug problem. And equally, the absence of those factors doesn't fully protect or mitigate young people from developing a problem with drugs. So I think as a parent or as a youth worker or even a professional who's involved with young people, the rather than going for the kind of let's try and catch them out with their drug use approach, I think it may sound a cliche, but just ensuring there's open channels of communication and that it's not all the interactions aren't just about, you know, stuff that's really serious around mental health and drug use, but rather it's just about building rapport and ensuring that trust is there is far more important, I think.
Right. But are there any particular red flags that professionals, teachers, and also parents and friends should look for as a sign that a young person is starting to have a problem with drugs?
Yeah, I mean, it's in part, it might vary drug by drug, you know, so certain drugs produce certain behaviours and ways of acting. And therefore, you know, the signs and symptoms, as it were, will vary a little bit. But more broadly, I guess anything that you notice that's a bit unusual, so the person isolating themselves, perhaps, you know, asking for money more than they would do, being a bit secretive or a bit guarded, or the other way, you know, just being behaving out of character. And I think parents are quite well placed to spot this. So someone who just appears a bit more talkative or a bit more outgoing than they usually are might be the sign of a young person using a stimulant, for example. But you'd want some other way of corroborating that. And hopefully, if you're able to, is you know, the best way is just to find the right time to talk to the person about it. And maybe raise your concerns, you know, just be open and say, look, this is how it appears to me. What do you think? You know, and it's done from a point of concern and rather than a point of, as I say, trying to catch someone out.
Mm-hmm. And let's suppose that discussion takes place between a worried adult and a young person. If there does then appear to be a problem, where can they signpost that child for help?
Well, I think it would depend on what's going on, you know. So, again, I think for many people, that conversation might be sufficient and there's no need to bring anyone else into it. I think, obviously, if it's something that the young person and the parent feels is a bit more serious and they feel out of depth with, then, you know, there's some really good online resources. And probably my first port of call, other than online, would be to go and see, you know, your family doctor. I think that's slightly easier to access than maybe a specialist drug service, because specialist drug services are really orientated around adults in the main. And I don't think those are easy places to walk into for a parent or for a child. I think I would go down the route of trying to get some help from your local family doctor. If you don't feel that's got you anywhere, or you know you're not being taken seriously, then yeah, I think you could try and get some help from your specialist drug team, of which there'll be one in every area up and down the country.
When you mentioned online resources, are there a couple that you can mention?
Yeah, there's, I think they're on the topic guide, but you know, websites that are run by some of these larger drugs charities. So, for instance, Ad Action provide a really good website, good basic information around drugs. Drugwise is another one. So both of, and there are others. And also, I'd say Talk to Frank, which is the government's website. It's really improved over the last year. It used to be a bit one-sided in the information it gave, as in it was all, you know, negative and scary around drugs, and they seem, somebody worked on it and balanced it up a bit more. So I think those three websites, so Ad Action, Drugwise, or Talk to Frank, the government website, are three good ways to try and get information.
Okay, great. If something more specialist is required, what types of interventions are around that have been shown to be helpful?
Well, that's part of the problem. We have some interventions for adults, but there are very few, if any, of these interventions which are tested on particularly young adolescents. Although these young people may be offered things like motivational interviewing or cognitive behavioral therapy or even substitute prescribing where that's appropriate, none of those have really been evaluated for young people. What we do know, however, is whether you're young, middle-aged or old, the thing that seems to make the biggest difference in this area is nothing fancier and grander than the ability of the therapist to form rapport. So to be honest, to be engaging, to give time, to be respectful, and someone that builds trust. So it seems that irrespective of the intervention, it's actually the therapist who makes the biggest difference. And again, it almost seems like common sense, but it's worth saying, you know, if you are able to find a therapist with all those qualities, it improves the outcomes, i.e. improves the benefits that you'll experience when you do go for help.
Mm-hmm. And to find that therapist, that would be through your GP or through your local drug service?
Yeah, either probably, as I say, the GP in the first instance, because they'll have that relationship and know how to access their local drug team in the first instance, if that's what they recommend. So, yeah, that would definitely be the first port of call.
Right. You've already mentioned this, but you've described the research and evidence base for clinical interventions as adult-centric.
Yeah.
What should be done to change that, or what is being done?
Well, I think very little. And part of the reason for that is, understandably, researchers probably find young people quite difficult to, well, certainly as a topic and as an issue, find it quite difficult to engage with. You know, you've got all the ethical issues to deal with, in addition to trying to recruit and keep in touch with young people once you started a trial. But I don't think that should deter us from doing it. You know, I'd like to see some funding calls from some of the big research funders to view this as a priority, because we know that if we intervene early, not only is it economically sensible, but also just in terms of nipping in the bud any drug problem careers that might be developing at that age, we can really, as I say, stop and find alternative ways for people to get the help they need with whatever issues they're trying to use drugs to mitigate. So I think, you know, it makes sense to intervene as early as possible. Having the evidence base to support that is something we desperately need. And I'd like to see research funders really get behind that and make it a priority.
And are there any research projects that you're aware of that are worth mentioning around this
area? No. Not really, not in terms of clinical interventions. I mean, there are some really good good pieces of work being done around drugs education, which is more around, you know, what should you offer in schools. So, again, I refer to that in the topic guide. There's a bit more information on that, because that's been a really troublesome area to try and work out what's best. And actually, some of the older drugs education stuff given to young people actually made them more interested in drugs rather than less interested. So it's a really important area that we get right.
Right. What happened there? What type of thing that would have the opposite?
Well, we think what happened was, you know, this, you can imagine what it's like, you know, in a school assembly, you wheel in the person who's in recovery, which is fantastic. They, you know, are full of all sorts of stories of what their journey through addiction was like. You perhaps have the police there who talk about what will happen, et cetera, et cetera. And we think what that might be doing inadvertently, and it's obviously not the intention, but is actually sparking an interest in some young people in drugs that they wouldn't otherwise have had. So it's that classic thing, isn't it, of saying to people, don't do something, and they do the opposite, you know. So that's the last thing we want. And also some people, I think, some young people, when they heard all these scare stories, they couldn't really relate to it. It wasn't relevant to their experience with drugs. So, again, this is why the Talk to Frank website is a bit more balanced now, and why any information given to young people or adults, for that sake, should be balanced. It should talk about pleasure as well as harm, because that's what people will recognize and be able to relate to. And it's just far more credible than trying to scare people.
Right. What policy changes or further clinical guidelines or training would you like to see to help prevent addiction in young people?
Well, I think one of the easy wins we could have, and I'm completely baffled as to why it hasn't happened yet, is the joining up of mental health and addiction services. So I find it a curious separation given the crossover there is between the two. You know, most young people who will develop a drug and alcohol problem or have the early signs of it will also be embarking on a career in mental health as well. So if we could provide training and easy access to services which are fully integrated rather than separate and sat in silos, I think we could learn a lot from each other. And most importantly, we could ensure that young people get the kind of integrated and joined up help they need at the right time in the right place.
Is that starting to happen anywhere?
It is. There's one or two examples. I suspect unless there's any kind of central government push behind it or by the Department of Health, they'll remain quirky and unusual rather than the norm. So there's areas such as those in Manchester, which have a more integrated service for adults and young people. And that's ready to be, celebrated. But as I say, I suspect it's an outlier and looks as it might remain that way unless there's some kind of impetus from central government to really get behind that nationally to integrate services. And I guess it's one of the things that must be really hard for people working with young people, whether they're nurses or, you know, whatever other profession they come from, is they tend to be trained and have experience and confidence and skills in one of the areas, but not both. So those workers who are really experienced and know their stuff around mental health, but lack the confidence and the knowledge around what to do with people who have drug problems and vice versa. So a lot of this is just about giving staff the confidence and the know-how, which is particularly expensive.
Right. I'm assuming then that some young people who have an addiction but do have mental health needs get siloed off into one section. Somebody would say, well, they just have an addiction, it's not a mental health issue, and they actually don't get those needs supported then.
Yeah, absolutely, which I guess is frustrating for those young people, or worse, just means that perhaps they do get some help with their drug problem, but their depression or anxiety continues. So that obviously increases the risk of relapse. So it's not to say that over time they won't get through all that, but we could speed up the process of recovery. And there are also some interesting gender differences that we see in adults that I think need to be explored in young people. So we know that young women, when I say young women, I'm talking about young adult women rather than adolescent women. We know that young adult women go from exposure to drugs to developing a problem much faster than men do. So they develop their drug problem in a matter of a few years, compared to men, who it takes a little bit longer for. And I suspect that's probably true for young women as well, girls rather.
Okay. And is that a physiological difference, or?
It's probably a combination of both. It's probably, a mixture of environment and something biological as well. But again, we can't even speculate what that's about. It's just an observation, which I think needs probing and exploring a little bit more.
Right. What's in the pipeline? Can you talk through any areas of research or innovative schemes that are yielding interesting results?
Yeah, I think I am, to go back to what we've mentioned, I am encouraged by what we've seen around young people in education, because I think that's got an obvious kind of advantage to it, in that it not only might help those who already have a problem in getting the help they need by being signposted or knowing where to get help, but it also might prevent young people from developing a problem. So I think, you know, God help us, schools seem to be asked to do more and more, don't they? But, you know, at school, at those really informative and important years, if we can offer some information for young people that prevents them developing a problem, or if they are on the verge of developing a problem, gets them the support and help they need, then that's great. And it seems like that evidence is working. It's being translated into practice. It's being implemented. We need some follow-up from it. And unfortunately, that's again, the kind of research that doesn't really get funded. We tend to fund research which maybe lasts a year or two, but doesn't follow young people up for 5-10 years. And that's what we need.
Right. So has there been some research into what educational messages or schemes are effective?
Yeah, there has. And, you know, to their credit, the government through the Department of Health has funded that and really put its weight behind it, having seen the outcomes of that. So, you know, often we can say this, but we have to thank politicians for adopting the evidence and for putting their money where their mouth is and rolling it out across the country. So that's fantastic.
Right. So it sounds like the need now is for more research into child-centric research into what works clinically.
Absolutely, because no matter how good those educational interventions are, we'll never get to zero. There'll always be kids, unfortunately, who'll develop a problem. So being able to have a menu of options for clinical interventions which have good evidence behind them and have been tested on children, perhaps, you know, as we do with adults, we need to engage those children in a conversation about what they think might work. You know, quite often young people's voices are missing from that type of research. And although adults are increasingly being invited to participate, I'd hope the same is also true of young people. They have the knowledge, they have the firsthand experience of what worked and what didn't work for them.
Ian, you've written the ACAM topic guide on addiction, as we've mentioned. Can you give a short summary of some of the themes that you've included in this?
Broadly introduce what the issues are with addiction. We've, you know, what we're talking about. We're talking about just a few young people. Are we talking about most young people, etc.? Then the guide takes you through what we already know. So, for instance, talking about the particular drugs that young people are exposed to and develop a problem with. It then moves on to areas of uncertainty, and that's probably where we focused a little more in this discussion, is, you know, uncertainty around the problems that some young people face and the solutions to those problems. And then a bit of a glimpse into the future, so what's coming down the road and what we can look forward to in terms of young people and drug use and drug problems, sorry.
Brilliant. Ian, is there anything you'd like to say that I haven't asked?
You know, I think this is a really important area to be working in for anyone working with young people. You know, very obviously, it's a critical period in life. And if we can help people at this stage and set them off on the right track and set them up well with, you know, a good relationship with services, then, you know, that's a major achievement.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a takeaway message for those listening to this podcast?
Yeah, I think I'd go right back to the beginning, and that is, you know, looking at this at a macro level, just looking at the population. I think what we really need to remember is most young people don't use drugs. And one of the problems we have in research and in practice is we only see young people that develop problems, and we can perhaps end up with a slightly squinted view or a biased view of young people and drugs. So if we remember that most young people don't use drugs, and of those that do, the vast majority experience pleasure. It's just unfortunately there is a small but significant number who do develop a problem. And of course, those are the ones that we're asked to see, not all the ones who do fine.
Ian, thank you ever so much. You can find Ian Hamilton's topic guide on addiction and substance use on the ACAM website, that's www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.